Did I just speak to you?
You sick of me yet?
Never.
Oh, you're such a schmoozer.
Only with people I like.
And me.
Yes, and you.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Red alert! All crew members report to battle stations.
Red alert. Shields up.
What shields?
You Starfleet officers! Now start acting like it!
Oh, it's just Garrick. Plain, simple, Garrick.
Dax, we might have just discovered the first stable wormhole known to exist.
The wormhole does bring them our way, doesn't it?
Everyone wants a piece of the new frontier.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
Quite a motley crew you've assembled here, Benji.
Listen to The Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast. And here are your hosts, Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro.
Bloody hell. Oh, I love a woman in uniform.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast, a Two True Freaks presentation. We always do this, don't we? What am I doing? Once again, we are your guide to every single episode of the Fantastic Four. To every single episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Maybe you should have done this introduction. I completely cocking up what show I'm doing. I am Andrew Leyland, and I'm here every week with my lovely New York friend, Mr. Paul Spataro.
Hello.
In technology, great.
It is. And you know what I am today?
What?
Tickety boo.
Hey! It sounds so natural.
I'm not sure anything I ever say sounds natural.
Today's episode is all about The Collaborator, which is Season 2, Episode 24. Is that right?
Sounds right.
Yeah, Episode 24, that's right, because there's two more left in the season. And we'll be getting to that in just a moment. But as usual, it's our customary discussion of Star Trek news. Is there any Star Trek news?
The movie probably opened.
And we've not seen it, or have seen it, depending on our point of view. I've read Star Trek Planet of the Apes.
I read Star Trek Planet of the Apes several months back, and I enjoyed it, but I can't say I retained a great deal. So as you talk about it, you may have to remind me of some of the more subtle details.
There are many subtle details. It's good. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it, but it's very simple. The Klingons have basically found a way to go to alternate universes. So we should have discussed this in last week's episode, really. They've gone to the Planet of the Apes universe, and the Klingons are basically supplying arms to the monkeys. Kirk and Co must stop them. That's pretty much it.
My big thing about the Star Trek Planet of the Apes, my big pluses to it were I liked the fact that the character models were the original series actors, not the reboot.
Yep.
And as is well known already, I have no problem with the reboot actors, but I just kind of like, you know, if you do a cartoon, there's no reason you can't stick with the original, you know, the original looks.
I don't think it would have worked with the new cast.
I don't know. I'm not sure. But I do. I also think that this is the only Planet of the Apes, other than versions of the movies. This is the only one, the only fanfic, I guess, where George Taylor was in it that I've ever read.
Yeah, because I did like that about it. I did like that it takes place before the second one, which is Beneath, isn't it?
Yes.
So it takes place before Beneath, but within the story, they give you an in-story reason for how Cornelius Zira and the third one who gets killed can go back in time at the beginning of Escape From. That was clever, that he manages to tie all of those three films together within Star Trek continuity. I thought that was quite neat. And I did like the touch that when Kirk and Spock go undercover on the Planet of the Apes, they're wearing the costumes that the guys in the TV show wore.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I thought that was funny.
I also liked the fact that there was conflict. It wasn't immediately that you know, Kirk and Taylor were on the same team.
No, well, they're two completely different characters, so they wouldn't like each other, I wouldn't think. And he's very downbeat and pessimistic, isn't he? Whereas Kirk's quite an optimistic character. So, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed reading it.
What would you, if you were giving it a Back to the Bins rating on the series as a whole, where would you give it?
Oh, I don't know. Is it Lars?
What's that?
Do you do Lars as rating?
No. We give it like a school grade, you know, A to F.
No, because I was going to say I'd probably give it 4 Lars. La, 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 la. A to
that's,
F.
That's good enough, though. Four, yeah. What would that be, out of 5?
Yeah, out of 5, I give it 4. Because it is very nostalgic. Mm-hmm. And it does play on, it's very much written for the fans. But I don't mind that in a comic book.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I found it to be more... You know, it's another one, you know, you read it and you're done and you move on. It's not like it's going to have any kind of lasting impact or whatever. But I found it to be more weighty than some of the other Star Trek, you know, comic books that I've read.
It's a fun read.
Yeah, a lot of the Star Trek comic books almost have the feel of those, you know, those gold key ones where they're just, you know, they feel like they're just churned out sometimes. This felt like it was done with a loving hand, at least.
Yeah. I agree. I'm looking forward to you giving it a full episode.
Yeah, well, we talked about doing an episode of Bins on it at some point. And perhaps, you know, if we ever get to that, maybe we'll see if you're available to be on it with us.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Okay.
I was just going to say, do you want to do a Bible entry before we go into the episode?
That's what I was just going to suggest as well. That was quick enough that maybe we should just do a Bible entry. So let me just open up my Bible. It sounds so... Doesn't that sound terrible?
Yes.
Okay, it's opening, and there we are. And let's see what we have. The Bajoran Wormhole, Deep Space Nine, Runabouts, Bajor, Benjamin Sisko we did already.
Yep.
Kira and Nerys we did already. And the next one is Miles O'Brien, which we have not done yet.
Okay, let's talk about Miles.
Okay, O'Brien has been the transporter chief on STTNG for 5 years. This assignment represents a promotion to Master Chief of Operations and a tremendous career opportunity for him. He's an Irishman, a man's man, with a down-to-earth quality. He's organized, efficient, and smart, and knows the hardware as well as any man in the fleet. He loves his work. He has a wife, Keiko, and a 3-year-old baby girl, Molly. He will be in charge of the comings and goings of vessels, plus the nuts and bolts maintenance of the station. He's constantly frustrated by the jerry-rigged way this place is put together. Before he joined the crew of the Enterprise, he served aboard the USS Rutledge along the Cardassian border during territorial disputes that led to bitter fighting. He saw the Cardassians commit unspeakable atrocities and lost close friends in the massacre at Setlik 3. The war changed him, hardened him. The first man he ever killed was a Cardassian who jumped him on patrol. As he tells the story to another Cardassian in the STTNG episode The Wounded, he says, "I'd never killed anything before. When I was a kid, I would worry about having to swat a mosquito. It's not you I hate, Cardassian. I hate what I became because of you." I think the way that's written, you would expect him to almost have a little bit more post-traumatic stress disorder than the way he's portrayed on the show.
I think that was the original intention, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think originally, you know, he was intended... I think it's very telling that he's the third person listed in the Bible. He was intended to be a bigger role than he was.
Than he developed into.
But I think he has become already on the show a solid part of the ensemble cast, but really should not be a featured player. I don't think I don't think his character is compelling enough as a featured player. But as a member of the ensemble, I think he's terrific.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think he's more of the everyman character that this stuff happens to than he is actually the prime driver of the storyline. And I think it's telling that we basically got to the point where every season had a torture O'Brien episode, because that's basically all they could do with him. At the end of the day, Brian isn't a Captain Kirk. He's not an adventurer. He's not a hero. He goes to work. He does his job. And like 99.9% of us, at the end of the day, he just wants to go and watch TV with his wife. That doesn't make for compelling television.
Yeah, I kind of agree. And the one part where it came up a while back that I thought they could have shown a little bit of that and given him a little bit more depth was the one, I don't remember which one, but they were I think it was the Circle. They were having everybody leave the station, and only a few people stayed, and he was among those who stayed. And I think we discussed it then that it would have played better if he had said, you know, I love you guys and I love this all, but I got to take care of my wife and daughter and I got to get them off the station. And if he had let himself be evacuated. Because at that point, he really didn't add anything further to the episode. But I think having him choose his wife and daughter over the station would have been something that would have given him a little bit more of a three-dimensional quality than everyone else in the crew.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's a good character. He's a solid character in Cold Mean. He's a solid actor. But I don't want to say the O'Brien episodes are ever my favourites, because they're probably not.
Yeah, well, so far we haven't had a good O'Brien episode.
I think we do get a couple as we go along.
I'm trying to remember, and I'm not sure. You know, I mean, he's been fine as a member of the cast and in the background, but when they focused on him, the only thing I can think of, the storyteller they focused on him.
Yeah.
The episode, was it Cardassians, the one with the refugee boy? Hmm. I thought he was perfectly used in that. You know, because he wasn't the focus of things, but, you know, he did give a different point of view and kind of, you know, presented the, you know, how people looked at young Cardassian kids and all of that. So I thought, you know, that's the perfect use for him.
Yeah, well, I think the thing with O'Brien is once they started pairing him up with Bashir, it actually gave him something to do.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I do think he is like I say, I go to work, I'm not friends with any of the people I work with. So I would imagine that a TV show about our workplace would just have me as a minor supporting character. I don't go and hang out with them at the end of it. I come home and I'd rather be with my family. And I think that's O'Brien's appeal. He is us. But like I said, that doesn't make for dramatic TV writing. So he kind of fell into the background for the more interesting characters, of which Kira is one and Odo. And then when Worf comes in later, these have got much more interesting personality quirks and much more interesting backstories that lead to more dramatic storylines than what Bashir's got.
And Sisko and Dax.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have a very large cast here. And not everybody is going to be able to be a featured player. I mean, that's the bottom line. And I think they did a really good job over the course of 7 seasons of focusing on everybody just enough that you don't feel that they sold you short on anybody.
Yeah, that's pretty much, yeah. I don't really have much to say about O'Brien.
Yeah, well, you know, my whole observation of O'Brien has been, since we started the show, was, you know, obviously they brought him over as the familiar face and they thought he was going to be more significant to the show than, you know, then it ultimately worked out too.
Yeah, I like that Bible entry. Basically, that was just all stuff from Next Generation.
Yeah, well, he's the only one, basically, who came in here with a fleshed-out background. You know, you already had a little bit of a Bible for him before the show even started.
Yeah, so it's not like they've had to give much thought to his character.
Mm-hmm. And I think they thought, you know, people were going to say, oh, yeah, I know that guy, and that they were going to latch onto him, but I don't think that really happened.
Okay, alright, well, that's this week's Bible entry. Do you want to discuss the episode?
Sure thing.
Okay, well, my synopsis, I don't know where your synopsis came from for Crossover, but it was very succinct and very good. Mine's probably long-winded again. It's from the Deep Space Nine Companion, because as we've established on this show, we're far too lazy to write our own synopsis. The collaborator story was by Gary Holland, teleplay was by Gary Holland, Iris Stephen Burr, and Robert Hewitt Wolfe, and was directed by Cliff Bold.
He wants to become Bajor's leader.
You are destined to be the next Kai.
And Kira has fallen for him.
I love him, Odo.
Now, an accusation from the past.
He worked for the Cardassians!
Puts his fate in her hands.
Do you want to risk having a collaborator as the next Kai?
He is not a collaborator.
Is Kira's lover a traitor?
I trusted you.
She's gonna destroy you.
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
It is a difficult time for Vedic Barail. Do I always say that name wrong? Is it Barail?
I think it's Barail.
Right. It is a difficult time for Vedic Barail. In 2 days, the Bajorans will elect a new spiritual leader, and, as the late Kai Upaka's personal choice, it seems certain that Barail will be chosen. But Barail is troubled by the disturbing visions he has seen in the Orb of Prophecy and Change, visions that imply his involvement with the suicide of Prylar named Beck. Not even the feelings he has for Kira, who has become his lover, can bring him inner peace. Following a visit to the station by Barail, Kira encounters Vadak Wynn, Barail's opponent in the upcoming competition. Knowing of Wynn's likely involvement in the attempt on Barail's life months earlier in the episode In the Hands of the Prophet, Kira is suspicious of her presence on Deep Space Nine. Not long after Wynn's arrival, a Bajoran named Cubus is spotted on the station. Known as a Cardassian collaborator, Cubus is quickly surrounded by a mob, then arrested by Odo as Wynn watches nearby. Cubus, who was exiled from Bajor after the occupation, tells Odo and Kira that he wishes to live out his remaining years on Bajor. Kira refuses, but soon discovers that Vedic Wynn has offered Cubus sanctuary and plans to take him home. As Kira and Odo try to figure out her motivation, Odo recalls that prior to coming to her decision, Wynn had used the computer. They learn that Wynn was researching the Kendra Valley Massacre. 43 Bajoran freedom fighters, including Kai Opaka's son, were killed by Cardassians when the alleged collaborator Prylar Beck betrayed their location. Beck committed suicide shortly after the incident. Major Kira refuses to allow Wynn to leave the station with Cubus. Wynn then reveals that in exchange for sanctuary, Cubus has agreed to provide the name of the real collaborator, Vadak Barail. It was Barail who ordered Beck to reveal the information to the Cardassians, Wynn explains. Kira doesn't believe the accusation, so Wynn offers her the opportunity to prove Barail innocent before the accusations become public. Kira questions Cubus and learns that Barail came to see Beck the day before he hung himself. Barail claims he came only to counsel the Prylar, whose guilt over the massacre was overwhelming. But Odo reveals that the communications records between Beck and the Vedic Assembly for the week prior to the Kendra incident have been sealed, something only a Vedic like Barail could order. Odo and Kira get Quark to bypass the seal, and they learn that the transmissions have been erased. O'Brien can't recover the data with the speed that Kira needs, but he can identify the person who erased it, Barail. When Kira confronts Barail, he explains that Beck was ordered to reveal the location of the Resistance fighters. Otherwise, the Cardassians would have killed every resident in the vicinity, taking some 1,200 lives versus 43. Disillusioned by his involvement, Kira prepares to inform Wynn, only to discover that Barail has already withdrawn from the election. This surprises Kira. She knows that if Barail was guilty, he would have revealed his culpability to the people rather than sidestepping the issue. Kira goes back to her investigation and discovers the truth. Returning to Bajor on the day Wynn is declared the new Kai, Kira again confronts Barail. He reluctantly confirms her findings. Kai Opaka was the collaborator who ordered Beck to reveal the information, not him. She had sacrificed the life of her own son to save the lives of 1,200 people. Barail has sacrificed his career in order to protect Opaka's memory. The end. Alright, I'll go first. I did the synopsis. It's a good episode. It's an interesting episode. It's a very well written episode. It's more interesting from the point of view of what it's doing than what it is in actuality. As an episode in and of itself, it's very enmeshed in Bajoran politics. There's a lot of continuity here that refers back to previous episodes, and for a lot of people, this was a massive turnoff. However, going forward, this now means that Kai Wynn is the Kai, which puts Deep Space Nine in a much more difficult situation when dealing with the Bajorans, and that is far more interesting in terms of possible future conflict, because Kira absolutely hates her and Sisko doesn't trust her, but now they're going to have to work with her because she is now the religious leader of the planet, a very prominent position. So it positions the show in a more interesting place going forward for potential conflict and drama than this episode itself provides. Did that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think having Barail become the Kai eliminates...
There's no conflict there.
It eliminates there? Conflict, because now they have a friend in the high office. And if they had followed through with that, which seemed to be the natural progression of where they were going, then they would have had to do something to create conflict. They would have had to have him make a decision, you know, kind of that went against his desires for the betterment of the world. And I mean, it was doable, from a script writing point of view, but this one, not only do the conflicts just come out at you so easily, but from a purely from a show point of view, the idea that you're going to be able to have that conflict with Louise Fletcher is so much more appealing than having Baryl, who is Philip Anglim. He's fine in the role, but he's not Louise Fletcher.
No, I just think he's dull.
I think he plays the part the way he's supposed to play. I think it's written dull. That's the thing.
Right, okay.
So my
problem with that is I really don't see what Kira sees in him.
I don't know, maybe
he's got a
big package.
Maybe that. Maybe it's the way he rubs his nose ridges in certain places. I don't know. It's entirely possible that Kira just longs for the quiet life after the life that she's led. And maybe she thinks that's what he represents. I don't know.
Before we go any further, I'm going to give in Blaine's take on the episode as part of our most recent featured addition to the show is, what does Blaine say? Here we go. Hi, guys. Some thoughts on the collaborator. The premise makes it hard to really get me to engage in the story, as the writers have wanted us to sympathize and support Vedic Baryl over Vedic Wynn so long. I assumed from the start that he'd take the blame for the crime to protect someone else. Nonetheless, the fantastic dialogue and banter captured and held my interest throughout. Between Quark's realization that Kira and Odo wanted something from him, Baryl's pleasure and providing both an opposing viewpoint to Wynn and ongoing support in the future, and Kira's intention to increase station security, we've got kind of character interplay that makes me want to pay attention as they arrive at the seemingly inevitable outcome. It's the character work and serialized storytelling that set DS9 apart from the rest of Trek, and both are plainly visible here, Blaine. I agree with what he's saying, except I did not think that that they were going to come right out and have him take the blame for somebody else. I thought maybe they were going to add a layer to his character, make him a little less dull, as you pointed out, that it was going to be, that he did take this on himself, and that he did it because he thought he was serving the greater good. And now he was going to have a little bit more of the moral ambiguity that Kai Wynn has. And I thought, that would let him continue to be a character that we could revisit from time to time. I don't know if we see much more of him from this point forward, because I feel like his character arc is done.
I think he's in a couple of future episodes. Doesn't he get killed off?
He may. I don't recall, honestly.
I don't either.
I do feel like his character arc is done. They don't really need him anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Blaine's saying, really, and I agree with you. So there's not really much conflict in this episode either. To actually have given him a flaw would have made him a Deep Space Nine character. And as it is, he's doing the honourable thing of covering for his mentor and somebody who means something to the planet generally. And whilst it's noble that he's falling on his sword that way, it doesn't make him any more interesting. And no. So we're left at the end of this episode, like Blaine says, reaching the inevitable conclusion that Wynn is becoming the Kai, because that is better for the show. And whilst this episode isn't completely dull because of, like Blaine says, the character interplay and the moving the characters around and the acknowledgement that previous events have happened and continue to have ramifications, as an episode in and of itself, it's not that interesting, even though it isn't badly done.
Well, to have Kyle Parker as the person who decided to make that betrayal of that one outpost, it deepens her character a little bit, because you set up a situation where she's not quite as saintly as you thought, because she is making this hard decision and sacrificing her son. Although it almost turns her into more of a martyr. Whereas if it had been Baryl that had done it, or Baryl who had done it, I think that adds more depth to his character, instead of taking a character that's basically gone from the series anyway. Like I said, if he's making the tough decision, and if he's going against what he's supposed to do, I think, you know, on an ongoing basis, he would have become a more interesting character. So I think that was the choice that made him less interesting, was that he's, you know, now he's the martyr.
Yeah. And so because the episode ends, though, with the implication he's going to be more involved as we go forward, because Kira's in a relationship with him.
Well, we'll see. I don't. Like I said, I don't know how much more of him we see at this point.
I don't.
But we know we're going to see more of Louise Fletcher and how to get better.
Well, that's what I was just. Let's just emphasize the positive. Louise Fletcher's brilliant.
She is every
conniving. I was just going to say she is every conniving politician who manipulates the situation to her advantage at every opportunity. She hides behind her religion when it's a benefit to her, but he's perfectly happy to throw people under the bus if it's of benefit to her, irrespective of whether it's good for the company. Sisko sees immediately that getting her to be seen with him kind of endorses that he's supporting her bid for Kai, so he refuses to have that photo taken or be seen on the promenade until after the election. And as soon as she wins that election, she's like, I don't need to be seen with him anymore, it doesn't matter. She's just magnificent throughout the show. The way she manipulates Kira is exceptionally well written and well played. And there's that brilliant bit where she says, I know you're under a lot of pressure, child, but do never speak to me like that again, which just shows the kind of person that she really is. The mask slips for a minute. She's been one of the most valuable players in the show from the beginning, and we're finally moving into a position where you remember from watching the show that she's going to be a more prominent part of it. And it's amazing how many of the possibly done in one guest star roles in Deep Space Nine ended up becoming almost regulars. There's Wynn, there's Garak, there's Dukat, later on there's Weyoun, there's all of those wonderful characters that aren't members of the regular cast but were allowed to stick around and explore. And she's fantastic in this episode.
Oh, absolutely. She's just, you know, she's always the character you love to hate.
Mm.
And you know, that comes from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on down. And I don't know, like, how much we've talked about her in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but I'm amazed I don't know if this is repetitive and if I've pointed this out before, but I'm amazed at the performance she gave in that movie and how powerful it was. And think about how small of a character she is in the movie, and yet she won Best Actress that year. And that just speaks to how powerful and how memorable her performance was. That you know, she's playing the nurse in the background. I mean, that's really, you know, it's a one-man show with a cast behind him. And yet she stood out enough to get Best Actress. So, you know, she's a tremendous actress and can play that character that you love to hate so well. They just can't have her on here enough, and you just want her to get, you know, you want there to be an accidental disruptor flyer into her or something, but not yet. That's the pleasure of watching her.
Yeah, she is absolutely brilliant. The other scene stealing the episode is Quark. The scene in the middle of the episode where they go to Quark to get him to do something plainly illegal, and this is Kira and Odo asking him to do this, is brilliantly funny. And it's the only scene that he has in it, but he almost walks away with the episode. Armin Shimerman. His brilliant delivery of the line, when Kira says to us, we're not accusing you of anything, and he just says, it's still early in the day, yeah, is fantastic. That it's, you know, I'm probably going to get accused of something. And he's, the way he plays, isn't that illegal? When they ask him what to do, Armin Shimerman steals that scene completely.
Well, also, even when Odo says, well, you could just do it this way. Well, sure, if you want to be clumsy.
Yeah, Shimmerman's brilliant in just the one scene, and it's a moment of much needed humour in the episode as well. Although, I really like the scene between Sisko and Wynn, where he declines politely to be seen with her on the promenade. I thought that was a really good scene as well.
Don't discount the scene too with Odo when Kira tells him that she loves Baril and his reaction to it. Because you can see plainly on his face he's shocked and upset, which is a harbinger of things to come on the show. And yet then he plays it off with, well, I'm surprised it took you so long to admit it to yourself. You Terrans, you know, like he just all of a sudden he becomes gruff about it. And from what I'm told for the most part, that was René Auberjonois, and they had not come to a thought that he was attracted to her yet. He decided that.
Right. Because it's a really good moment then, isn't it? If he's just put that into the scene and then the writers have spotted it and gone, we'll run with that. Because, yeah, the way he just pauses in his face, and the fact that he is able to do something with his face despite being caked in latex just shows what a remarkable actor he is.
Yeah, he really is. And you know, the fact that he decided to add that subtext to his character just shows how invested in the role he was.
Yeah.
I think some people just read their lines. I don't think that he's one of them. I don't think there's really anybody in the show who fits that description. And that's one of the things that makes this show great.
Yeah, they're all doing a really good job with it, aren't they? It's really good. One interesting note from the companion, Beryl was supposed to win.
Yes, but then they decided that it was a poor source of conflict.
Yeah, so that's good.
See, I think I like seeing
that was confirmed, though, that they actually did, that was the original script. I like seeing that was confirmed in the companion.
But like I said, I think you could create conflict by having to have Beryl faced with some tough decisions and going against the interests of the station and going against Kira's wishes and having them conflict. So I think that could have played out, but the problem with that is you would have been taking a, at best, mildly charismatic actor and placing him in the role that you have with an incredibly syrupy charismatic actress instead. I mean, to have him ahead of Louise Fletcher in the pecking order just, you know, doesn't serve the show. Because she's just so magnificent as a foil, that having her as Kai is just so much better.
Yeah, it's just, well, we know where it leads the show as well. It's just better for the show that Louise Fletcher is in that role. Not better for the characters, but then what's better for the characters isn't always better for the drama of the show. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, better for the characters is pretty much routinely not better for the show, because you need conflict, and characters don't want conflict, but the viewers do.
Yeah, we just want a quiet life.
Otherwise, it's dull.
Yep,
if everything works out in their favor, it's dull.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, though, I don't really have much else on this one. It's not that it was bad or anything. It's a very talky episode, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, there really is no science fiction principle that's presented in this one. It really comes down to politics and the politics of war. You know, from the politics point of view, obviously you have Win against Beryl and Beryl. I'm going to say it different every time. And this is your fault, because I never had this.
Yes.
But how
it's written on the page looks completely different to how they pronounce it.
But you have their political machinations, which he really doesn't do anything, because he's, you know, he's presented as kind of this sainted person. But you have Wynne's manipulation of things, which is just wonderful. You know, how she basically, you know, you get the impression she sat on this information until it would benefit her. And then she put the wheels in motion. And then to have her have Kira as the person who's investigating it is a masterstroke. That, you know, her attempted manipulation of Sisko, you know, there's just so much going on with her. And then just the condescending way she speaks to people. Even that little moment at the beginning where she says, you know, honor the prophets and they will love you. And then he comes out with, I thought the love was unconditional. You know, and her response to it was, well, that's the beauty of things, that, you know, you can have your own interpretation or something along those lines. Like, even then she doesn't back off from him and tries to make him sound, you know, silly. So, you know, she really did shine, despite the fact that I don't think she had a lot of screen time in this episode. But every moment was wonderful.
She dominates everything that's happening, because it's like Kira really does not want her to be the Kai, and Sisko wouldn't be happy if that happened. And you know that she's manipulating everything from behind the scenes. This is why when she does eventually get hooked up with Gul Dukat, it works so well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're a long ways off from that.
Which is a shame, because you just want it to get to that really meaty stuff. But it'll happen. It'll happen eventually.
It's a slow burn, and this episode added to that slow burn. So the other moral question or philosophical question was, you know, do the needs of the few outweigh the needs of the many? Because they sacrificed that one outpost to save the lives of thousands. So do you fight and make every life matter? Or do you say, you know, these 40-some-odd people get killed, but then in the grand scheme of things, that's a sacrifice we have to be willing to make to save the lives of whatever it was, 1,200 more people?
Yeah, and the fact that she sacrificed her own son to do it does give Kai or Packer a weight. But like you said earlier on, she's not on the show anymore, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that's why I would have liked it better if Baril had been the one to make that decision, and if he had done so without Opaka knowing. And you know, maybe you could have had him, you could have had a scene in there if he was capable of pulling it off acting-wise, which I don't know, with him just torn apart by it, the fact that, you know, he loved her and revered her, and yet he sacrificed her son, which caused her so much pain. You know, I mean, you could have had a meaty scene in there for him. Again, I don't know if his acting chops would have pulled it off.
I don't know. I don't really recall having seen him in anything else to be able to judge him, because that's normally where you come from. But yeah, he's spectacularly boring in this, let's be honest.
Oh yeah, no, I agree with you. You really don't know why Kira is so attracted to him, why she's in love with him, other than the fact that the script tells you that she is.
Yeah, because there's been a little bit of flirting between them before, but this does kind of come out from nowhere a bit.
Yeah, there's not, you know, and I'm not putting the blame on her. She plays the love-smitten person very well, but there isn't a lot of chemistry between the two of them.
Well, I do wonder how much of it is her compensating for his very laid-back approach.
Yeah, well, you see, in the scenes where they're together, you know, she's the one who's coming up, like, behind him and hugging him and you know, looking at him with those loving eyes and stuff, whereas he's just kind of, you know, stoic. So, you know, maybe it is that he's not, you know, not able to pull it off acting-wise, or maybe they didn't give it enough time with the two of them together for you to develop that feeling. But whatever the case may be, that the love affair doesn't, you don't really feel like you're losing anything on the love affair.
No. And like I said, I don't remember where it goes, but we'll see.
All right, I think that's about it for my notes.
Yeah, I don't have a lot on this one at all, to be honest with you.
You want to rate it?
I'm kind of torn on this one. On the one hand, I do actually think I want to give it 4. Because of what it means for the series as a whole. But we've discussed this before. That's not really fair, because I'm not judging the episode in and of itself. So, taken as a whole, it's 4. In and of itself, I think it's a 3. So we'll go with 3.
All right. Well, I had a similar dilemma on it, because I think that, you know, on a whole, it is more important and it moves the plot line and potential conflict forward, but that's not how we're supposed to be rating them. We're supposed to be rating these as if we don't know what's going to happen going forward. So I'm not going to go 4 either, but I think Louise Fletcher props it up enough that I'm going to go 3.5.
Right. That's fair enough. Yeah.
Just making my notes of our scores.
Right, all right. Do you want to go into emails then?
Yeah, we might as well, and I'll take the first one, which is our buddy Gene Hendricks.
Hey, Gene.
And it is titled, "Where's Charles Lawton? The bells, the bells." While this isn't a great episode, I did find it interesting that the Skrean males are described as being too emotional to be leaders and are shown to be such. I wonder if they made that argument in reverse and shown the females to act the same way as the males, would there have been any backlash? Okay, I'm going to stop right there. Absolutely there would have.
You think in the 90s there would have been?
I definitely think so, because I think...
All right, I think there would be nowadays, but I don't necessarily think there would have been so much in the 90s.
I think the reason why this works is because they're playing on the what is now viewed as a ridiculous stereotype of that women are weaker and not able to do things, you know, that at one time was accepted logic. So for that reason, doing it in reverse almost comes off as a, you know, satire, whereas playing it the other way and saying, look how ridiculous, you're saying these women are weak, look, we're going to make them look weak, I think would have been more insulting to people.
Yeah. All right, fair enough.
Okay, Gene goes on. That might have been the least subtle thing in the whole episode. Everything about this story is so, as they say on Mission Log, bonk bonk on the head, that I started to get a bit bored with it. Especially we're looking for our holy planet that's on the other side of the wormhole and has just been ravaged by invaders, telegraphing at the beginning. If my daughter had been paying attention, I'm sure that she would have picked up on how it would be Bajor. Speaking of that, it seemed kind of whiny for them to want to go to Bajor. But we don't want to go to the planet with no infrastructure. We want to stay here. Apparently they wanted to go to Tashi Station. I think it's telling that the only thing that really makes a difference in this episode is that now the Federation knows about the Dominion. Nothing else carries over to or from this episode ever. Gene. And Gene, as we've talked about, hosts the Hammer Strikes podcast, the Quantum Cast, Anime Freaks, and is a guest on a plethora of other podcasts because Gene's a good podcaster. And I'm happy that he's one of our, he is our listener.
Oh, no, we've got Tim Elliott listening as well.
That's true. We have a handful.
We do. But
I kind of agree with that thought process, and I have to say, looking at my log of our ratings, when we get to the final of the season, which is two episodes away, and we can revisit anything, I think I probably will lower my rating on this one. So, for what it's worth, I do kind of agree. This was a lackluster episode at best.
Next email, straight into Tim Elliott's email.
Sure.
Listen to the Prophets 29, or would you stop flaking on the bar? greetings, three wise men. Oh, sadly not three at the minute. Well, okay. Once again, you've delivered a great show from a not-so-great episode. I agree with most of your comments concerning this episode. I felt some of the writing was a little heavy-handed and clunky. I felt Anik's son was angry and combative for no reason other than plot convenience. I like the bit with the universal translator. This obstacle would have popped up more in later episodes and on Voyager. I like the ending, and it shows that the Bajorans are more damaged from the occupation than they think. Their mistrust had them overlook the possible benefits of letting the Skareen settle on Bajor. All in all, you three are always a joy to listen to, even when the episode is less than joyful. Great show, guys. Cheers, Tim Elliott. Well, you're very welcome, Tim.
Yes.
That was the one with the planet of the Pariasis people, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I vaguely remember that one.
No, I remember it, and I remember being higher on it than you and Sean, and at the time I thought, nah, this was, you know, an entertaining episode. I don't know, I could tell you. I rated it, I gave it a 4.
All right, okay.
You gave it a 2.5, and Sean gave it a 3. And,
so, all right,
as I said, in two episodes, when we do our finale, I think I will lower my rating. Because, you know, looking back in hindsight, yeah, it wasn't all that good.
Yeah, when we get to the looking at the season as a whole in two episodes' time, I think it's going to be interesting if we've revisited any and if we change our mind on anything.
Okay, looking to our email box, we have two emails that are from listeners who were not on the Facebook page and inquiring about the hiatus that the show took, and everybody's familiar with what went on there, so I'm going to pass those over. And just say, you know, the people who sent those, thank you for your concern and the sympathy that you showed. We really do appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to go to our last email in our bin for today, from, again, Gene Hendricks, called Humperdink in Space. Paul and Andy, let me start off with how hard that line above was to type. As with you, the loss of Sean hit me harder than I thought it would, having never met the man. While I'm happy that you're going to continue the show, I would not blame you if the show had ended. It's not easy moving forward after a loss like this, and I admire you both for doing so. I also want to thank you, whoever did the editing, for leaving all the talk in at the end. It's odd, but it was good to hear Sean's voice, even though he was talking about doing stuff that he would never get to do. And again, I'm going to interrupt there. That was the thing I found painful about it. When Sean would say things about, you know, I'd like to do this, I'm going to put this in my queue to watch in the future or whatever, and just the thought that he wasn't going to get to do the things that he was talking about doing, I did find very painful as I was editing the episodes. However, just hearing him talk and hearing him have fun with us and hearing us have fun with him just served as a reminder of you know, what we felt and the kinship that we shared. And I don't want to keep getting maudlin about this all the time. I want to try and, you know, make this a Deep Space Nine podcast. So just know that I consider it a blessing that we have these recordings, and I can kind of relive an aspect of my friendship with Sean by listening to them, for what that's worth.
Yeah, I think that's worth a lot. I think that's worth a lot. Don't put that down. That he's out there. He's still there. And he's still here. Told you this offline.
It's always in our hearts.
Yep. That's he's still sure. here while we're doing this.
Yeah. And he was such an integral part of this that his contribution till the show is over should never be left out. And as I was saying with Andy before we recorded today, every episode we do, I'm going to be thinking to myself, oh, what would Sean have thought of this? Or what would Sean have said about this? Or, you know, how would he have handled this differently? And his contribution to this show could never, ever be overstated. But I'm not going to say that every show because, again, I don't want it to be like, you know, every episode is that we're sad.
No, it's like Gene says in that opening paragraph, it isn't easy moving forward, but you have to move forward. That's what life is. If you don't keep moving forward, and it doesn't mean we're going to forget him, because we're not, and it doesn't mean that we don't think about him, because we do, and as I said just a minute ago, and as I discussed with Paul Offer, he's here. Every episode we do, every episode we record, until we get to the last one, he's here. He's here with us, and he always will be.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Gene goes on. Now on to the Star Trek Does Amos Fortune episode. It seems to me that whenever Star Trek writers are running thin on ideas, they try to make up a scientific explanation for something that doesn't have one. This one is luck. And they never actually explain it, do they? There's this machine that does something that changes how a subatomic particle spins. Right. Oh, and the replicators will make a copy of anything regardless of whether or not the computer can identify it. Good to know that all this stuff from the Gamma Quadrant, which could be potentially fatal to various life forms, can be copied ad nauseum with no problem whatsoever. Good point, Gene.
Yeah, I think we had a problem with that device when we actually talked about it, didn't we? That it was just dumb.
And the truly dumb part of it was trying to give a scientific explanation to it. Had they just said, oh, it's a machine that affects luck, I have no idea how it works, its principles are beyond me, they would have been much better off. O'Brien and Bashir were good in the episode, especially Bashir being worried that he'd end up killing the chief from overexertion. But it's just not enough to save the episode. Gene. P.S. Terry Farrell as Wonder Woman? Brilliant idea. Yes, I don't know how Terry Farrell is doing considering that we're now, I guess, 20 years removed from the show, but I'd still be curious to see.
Yeah, I think certainly had they done it in the 90s, she should have been a shoo-in for the part. But yeah, I don't know if she even still acts anymore. A lot of the Star Trek actors of this vintage seem to have given up on it.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. What can you say? It's the red-headed stepchild.
It is, which is unfortunate, because as we've established many times, it's pretty damn good. All right, that's it. Email sack's empty.
Yeah, we've emptied the email. We went into this looking at it as being quite daunting, but we've gotten through it all. I think the reason is our new feature on the show, What Would Blaine Say? Because we have an additional... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The next seven episodes, Blaine has a comment on.
Well, I hope he continues to send them in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What are we looking at in the future?
I was just going to say, next time on Listen to the Prophets, it's the annual Let's Torture Miles O'Brien episode, Tribunal. I don't remember anything about this one.
I don't either, but right now I'm kind of up on the idea of torturing Smiley.
Yep, and then we're just one episode away from the end of the season. So let's hope we go out with a bang.
And if all works out well, next episode we will have a special guest star with us.
Yeah, that'd be great if we can have a special guest join us for the last couple of the season. Is that it then?
I guess so. So goodbye, right, everybody.
Well, goodbye, everyone. I hope you enjoyed it. It was strange doing them without Sean, but like I say, he's still here. And we're going on, and we're going to carry on doing it, and we're going to do it for him. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.